CataractCoach.com. Welcome to podcast number 11, today with Samuel Maskett. Dr. Sam Maskett has really been a pioneer in the ophthalmology world, especially on the cataract side. We know the name from a lot of his innovations, a lot of the papers he's published, the research he's done, talking about how keratorefractive surgery affects IOL powers. He's done that. He's talked about negative dysphotopsia from IOLs, complicated reconstructive cases. Really, he's done it all. I also have the honor of being the last resident that Sam Maskett trained. Sam Maskett's always been a private practice, but he volunteered to teach the UCLA residents. And back in the year 2000, I was the very last resident that he taught. I jokingly say that maybe I broke Sam Maskett, but the truth is, it was time for him to move on and do bigger and better things. And now that I retired last year from teaching residents at the same program, I understand why. It's time to have different chapters in life. And that's one of the lessons we'll talk about today. Anyway, check out the podcast. It's really amazing. I know you're really going to enjoy it. All right. So welcome to the CataractCoach.com podcast. And today my guest is one of my very important mentors, Dr. Sam Maskett. I first met Dr. Maskett when I was a resident at UCLA in the late 1990s up to about the year 2000. And he showed me that you can have a tremendous amount of innovation in ophthalmology and leadership, but still do private practice. You can always do a combination of these things, and you don't have to relegate all the advancements in ophthalmology to the academic world, when in fact, most come from the private practice world. So you really served as an important mentor to me. And the other thing that I thought was really impressive was you taught me a different way to operate. When I was a resident, you assume that what you learn from your professors is that's all there is. They're teaching you everything. Whereas they're just teaching you the basics. And when you showed me how to do phaco chop in 1999, you basically blew my mind. So welcome, Sam. A really big honor for me.
Well, Uday, thank you so much for inviting me into this program of yours. You really do have a great service that's recognized worldwide. People look up to what you say and what you do. So I'm very happy to be part of this as well as to have been a mentor for you. I know you teasingly say that you broke me. In fact, that I stopped scrubbing with the residents after you. And the truth is, and the reality is that you had a zeal for cataract surgery that you don't ordinarily see anymore. And to me, cataract was in and of itself, you know, the most important part of ophthalmology, given the volume. And when you think about what it does for patients, I don't understand how people couldn't have a zeal for it. But in those days, when you were training, LASIK was really in its in its heyday. And residents, all they wanted to talk about, all they wanted to know, really was LASIK and or ophthalmic plastics. And I almost took that as a personal affront. But you had a real zeal for it. I'll never forget your response when I showed you capsule staining on that white cataract. That was even before TriPan Blue.
I think it was ICG Green, right?
It was ICG. Yeah. We were in Olive View, which is a general county hospital, but they had it in the urology department. We found it.
Yeah.
And I showed you how to dilute it. And it was like, you know, like watching you see sliced bread for the first time.
It was truly amazing. You know, especially that county hospital.
Yeah.
Cataract surgery, to get a patient with a white cataract and then your normal vision the next day, that is the best magic trick in all of medicine.
Yeah.
To make the blind people see normally in such a beautiful, elegant surgery. So you're right. I fell in love with cataract surgery.
Right.
It was just a different world too. And then after my residency, there weren't fellowships like yours. You offer a fellowship now where you can get a tremendous amount of experience in complicated cataract surgery, anterior segment reconstruction. That just didn't exist at the time.
No, it didn't exist. And, you know, I always had a zeal, so to speak, or an attraction to the very challenging cases. And so learning the techniques and or establishing the techniques was very, very special. So over the years, I did have a lot of those type cases get referred to me. And then I was blessed to have Nicole Fram join me, and she had that amazing zest as well. And she's incredibly talented. So passing the baton to her has not been a difficult challenge at all. And so it goes on and on. And then a few years ago, she said to me, you know, we really should have a fellowship. When We needed to establish a foundation to fund it, and on and on. So for my 70th birthday, she and my sons gave me the structure, the paperwork of a foundation. I like to say it was the worst birthday present I ever received, because the work has been unending.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm going to be 80 in 2 months, and so it's been 10 years of a lot of work. I'm so proud of what the foundation does. So we have Marissa Schoen, who was chief resident at Wills last year. She's our fellow now, and she's superb, and she's learning how to do these cases, and the foundation supplies the patients for her. So it's been a labor of love, but a lot of labor.
Yeah, it's fantastic to have a fellowship like that, to get experience in these tough cases. In L.A., you were, for the longest time, you were the one for tough cases. Even I remember starting practice, and, you know, only had maybe a 500 case under my belt, saw a really complicated case, and I just thought, let me send this to Dr. Maskin. It'd be a lot easier.
Yeah, I loved the opportunity to do those cases. Now that I don't do surgery anymore, I voluntarily stopped at 75. One of my mentors, Bob Sinsky, said to me, "You have to stop when you're 75. He said, "Otherwise, if you have trouble with cases and what have you with age, they'll blame your age on it. You won't be able to defend your age, and you'll be miserable in retirement." So I stopped at what I think was the top of my game. In fact, when I scrub with Marissa, I'm thrilled that I can still do it, but I would not recommend people be operating, you know, beyond certain ages. I use a lot of sports metaphors. I'm old, so my baseball heroes were Sandy Koufax and Willie Mays. Sandy was the best pitcher I ever saw, and Willie was the best all-around player I ever saw. But Sandy, because of an arthritic left elbow, retired at 31. He won 27 or 28 games in his last year. And, you know, he's been a hero. During baseball season, there isn't a week go by. He's in his 80s now.
Sure.
There isn't a week that goes by where he's not mentioned in the sports pages. Willie Mays, on the other hand, stayed till he was 42, which in those days was really ancient for a baseball player. He retired in 73. And he really didn't distinguish himself. He dropped a couple of fly balls in the 73 World Series when he was finishing his career with the Mets. And people don't revere him as they really should, sure, because he stayed too long at the dance. Well, I wanted to be Koufax. I didn't want to be Mays. So I stopped at 75. And now Nicole takes all those cases and does a great job with them.
Yeah, I took your advice to heart with that as well. So I actually, last year, 52, retired from teaching residents. Mm-hmm. So I retired from the academic duties. The same hospital you attended me, all of you, UCLA Med Center, was the same one where I taught for 22 years after residency and became chief there. But yeah, after I proved kind of what I wanted to, I made sure I retired at the very, very peak of my game. And I think that's a real smart move.
You know, I think we don't realize how our skills and our cognition degenerate with time. We're not aware of it. This is becoming a very important subject in ophthalmology today. There was a recent op-ed piece in the New York Times, "Would you trust a 100-year-old physician?" Mm. And we have a real aging, not only of the population,
sure,
but our profession as well. I happen to chair the Senior Ophthalmologist Committee of the Academy.
Okay.
One is automatically a senior ophthalmologist when they turn 60.
60.
You're getting it.
We
now represent 43% of the Academy.
Oh, wow.
That's increasing. So we have an aging of our profession, and we are not replacing ourselves as fast as we are retiring. We graduate 450 residents a year in this country. We're retiring a little faster than that. And while we're on the subject, one of the reasons that people retire is musculoskeletal diseases. Ophthalmologists, about 15% retire early because of
cervical disc disease.
Cervical or lumbar disc and other MSDs, wrist issues.
Right, sit up straight.
No, it's true. So these have become very important subjects to me, and they really go along. I don't want to get into the subject of wellness and burnout, but it's all part of that as well. So we have to keep our physicians working longer because our population is aging and we're retiring too soon.
Right. It seems like every year we're doing a higher and higher volume of cataract surgery in the U.S. Correct. Now 4 million a year. And now we have fewer people to do it. A lot more ophthalmologists working part-time. A lot of the younger generation is very smart, figuring out a work-life balance that maybe it's not all about work. A mistake I made early on, working 6 days a week.
You know, times, people, and issues change. When I was in training, we measured our value by how hard we worked.
Correct.
Yeah. Who had the most admissions the night before? Who could brag? You know, is that red badge of courage?
Who did the most volume of surgery?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Rather than thinking about ourselves. And while we're on the subject, we'll touch a little bit more on ergonomics. Nobody ever looked at how I was working with instruments and said, gee, you know, you should be sitting this way or what have you. It was never a concern for our physical well-being or our mental well-being. Well, that's changed, and I think that's changed for the better. I mean, I used to work 80 hours in a row.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, when I was an intern at Albert Einstein, it was disaster. But we did it, and there was a trade-off. The harder you worked, the more you learned.
Sure.
That was always that was the trade-off. You learn by working. And so I guess I didn't object. Also, if we go back a long time ago, the physician was in a very special place in society. We were highly respected for our caring, the amount of work we did, etc. A lot of that has changed as we've gone to the corporatization of medicine. I wanted to talk about cataract. I don't want to talk about the,
sure,
you know, the bad issues of the day, as it were.
But I mean, it's changing times. Yeah. I mean, even when I was a resident, we took in-house call. And the first, our PGY2, our first-year residents, we didn't want to do every fourth night. So we just do a week at a time. I'd just go to the hospital on Sunday, and I wouldn't leave till the next Sunday. And take call for the entire week.
Yeah, but people with families, you know.
No, of course.
When I was at Einstein, we did this weekend on where you'd come in Saturday morning, and you don't go home till Monday night. And the only advantage you got out of that, at the end of that week, you had two nights off.
Yeah.
So you could actually sleep in your bed one morning.
You could have a little bit of a life.
Right, exactly.
No, it's a tough balance. And yeah. I think the tough part we're getting into now is we're doing a higher volume of surgery. Each surgeon's going to have to do more and more volume. I think we may need to train more ophthalmologists.
Well,
that's obviously a complicated issue, too.
Well, it's a very complicated issue, but there's no question that we have and will have an increasing shortage, a shortfall in the amount of physicians across the board, and ophthalmologists in any of those particular specialties that deal with the aging.
Sure. Right?
And we, I mean, that's
cataract.
You know, give cataract, glaucoma, macular disease. I mean, that's who we are. So the amount of trainees really comes from government funding.
Yeah.
And when the government decides we need to train more ophthalmologists, we will. The concern, of course, is that we have no shortage of people who want to compete with us to do the cataract surgery. And we are outnumbered by optometry,
yeah,
by 2-1.
Do you think we'll get to the point where you have a non-physician doing intraocular surgery?
Absolutely.
Really?
I have no doubt in my mind. I think the more and more automated we become, look, Uday, it takes a long time to train us. It's very expensive to train us.
Yeah.
And the thing that really surprises me is that very few residency programs actually test you for dexterity.
That's exactly.
Right. In the old days, if you wanted to go to dental school, you had to carve a piece of chalk, right? If you wanted to go to pharmacy school, you had to roll a suppository.
Even ENT had the soap carvings.
Yeah. But in ophthalmology, where dexterity is everything.
Paramount.
Right. It's not tested for. Also, binocularity.
Yeah, stereoscopic vision.
Yeah, exactly. Nobody, well, there are some programs that do. I remember in my days in training in New York, there was a very prominent ophthalmologist, had about a 90 diopter XT, prism diopter XT. Right.
It's fixable.
He was way out here. Big practice in Brooklyn, very successful man. But again, we weren't doing microsurgery in those days, right? I mean, I started microsurgery as a resident, But the attendings hadn't done that, so maybe it didn't matter for him.
Well, part of it, too, is the world we live in. So I even asked, when I was involved with UCLA for many, many years, I said, we have this surgical simulator. And this is back when we were doing in-person interviews of the med students. And so we have a surgical simulator. Can we just put every applicant on, like, that quick 10-minute, you know, trial and just see how they do? Do they have any
coordination? Absolutely.
We were told resoundingly, no.
Right.
You can't do that. It's not fair.
Well, the long and short is you should do that. Because getting back to the point I raised, we are very time-consuming and very expensive to train.
Sure.
I think all the training we go through, and people may not have been tested for their skills, let alone their ability to think on their feet when something goes wrong. I had a concept years ago that with remote watching, a trained surgeon could watch 8 or 9 cases simultaneously, that you could train, you would search for very, very dexterous young people.
Sure.
High school, college students, and that you could teach them.
You may do it based on merit, Sam?
Yes. and right. And you could have these one trick ponies,
yeah.
Right? Well, all they could do was routine cataract surgery. And you could watch.
Right.
Now, if something happened, you know, the good thing about cataract surgery is you can stop at almost any point.
Sure.
And
have
transfer that
over. Yeah.
Exactly. So that was a thought that I had.
Well, one of the things, I talked to Tom Odie on a podcast,
yes,
and he says,
yeah,
it takes 2 years to train a fighter pilot,
right,
but 13 to train an ophthalmologist? Wait a minute.
Right. No, and I agree with Tom 100% on that.
Yeah.
So we're expensive, we're time-consuming, but now we are being replaced a lot by technology. We're no longer physicians, we're providers, and you know that whole game.
Yeah.
When I was a medical student, now I graduated 55 years ago. I graduated medical school in 1968. The cardiologist was king.
Yeah.
And I don't mean queen either, because there were no women that I knew who were cardiologists in the New York scene. So the cardiologist was king, because he could hear these little clicks and these little rubs,
mm-hmm,
and things like that with his Littmann stethoscope that we mortals
couldn't
hear. Well, what are you talking about? Today, the cardiologist never sees the patient. I mean, all the automated devices. Cardiologist looks at the printouts. Oh, okay, you know, we'll do this, that. So we, to a great extent, we've been replaced by technology. And you know, robotics are coming.
Sure.
I forget his name again at UCLA.
J.P. Hubschman. He actually took a sabbatical. And
yes.
I'm actually working with him in his company,
okay,
Horizon Surgical, to
okay,
do
so
robotic
they,
cataract surgery.
Right, and I've seen it. Plus, there's a European machine now that combines phaco and femto, and there's more automation,
sure,
in it. And we know that surgery will be automated to a great extent. Plus, we also don't know. Remember, all the machines today are trying to mimic what we do with traditional phaco.
Sure.
But the day the machine comes along
that
supplants traditional,
yeah,
phaco, then I think it'll be more and more automation, and I don't think you're going to need 13, 14 years to train an ophthalmologist.
Wow, you kind of shortcut that.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, another thing is, you know, not all ophthalmologists have to be surgeons. I was interviewing a residency program director, and she was explaining that, like, yeah, there are residents who she says you should strongly consider doing a uveitis subspecialty, mm-hmm, neuro-ophthalmology, a non-surgical subspecialty.
As an example, in Germany,
sure,
only about 8 or 10% of ophthalmologists actually do surgery. The others are office-based. In fact, it's almost, I was the monitor for a U.S. company developing an implant, a lens implant for Europe. And I went over to the surgery center in Munich area, and I said, well, when do we see the pre-ops? And he says, we don't. I said, well, when do we see the post-ops?
We don't.
I said, then how can we know, you know, how the patients do? That's the way it works in other parts of the world, where they're kind of like surgeons who operate all day, every day. That's
sure.
all they do. And, you know, I think people are jealous of those. But, you know, justice is when everyone is doing what they should do.
Right.
Right.
I mean, for years I worked with an older ophthalmologist just outside of L.A.
Mm-hmm.
who lined up all the patients. I just go there in the morning. He's already seen them all.
Mm-hmm.
And I would, the first time I'm seeing the patient is the day of surgery. And then he sees the post-op. I literally never see the patient again.
Right.
And there was something that, you know, we were able to do a huge volume of surgery very efficiently because of that.
Yes. And it, the only question is whether it's best for the patient,
sure,
not to know their surgeon. And that's something that I struggle with when I see the way practices are more and more now, where the cataract surgeon is seeing the patients hardly other than in the OR. In fact, I was talking with a colleague the other night about a different type of surgeon, an orthopedic surgeon. He said, the only way you're going to see him after surgery if you wake up during the procedure. So, I mean, I don't know if that's really the best way to go. In my view, my whole view of medicine is comes down to this one credo. If it's good for the patient, then it's good for the doctor, good for the profession,
sure,
and good for the industry.
For sure.
And if it's not good for the patient,
then nothing else matters.
That's exactly. So I don't really know, and I don't even know how to study that question.
Yeah.
But it is an important question, because at the end of the day, if it's not about the patient,
it's
not medicine.
Yeah, I know, for sure.
But, you know, I'm an old horse. People may differ with my philosophy, but that's what I think.
I think it's the right answer, too. I give the same treatment to patients that I'd want to receive. So I actually see all my patients pre-op. I actually see them all post-op.
Right.
Because if it was my eye, my surgery, that's kind of what I'd want.
And you brought right to the head, exactly. It really behooves you at some point in your life to be a patient.
Sure.
Because then you really understand what's important to the patient. Again, I'm old-fashioned. That's what I believe in. You can send me to the glue factory, but that's that's how I was trained. That's my philosophy about medicine.
No, I think it works the best, and patients can tell. Mm-hmm. When patients can tell that you really care about them, I think that's far more important to them than how smart you are or how good of a surgeon you are.
It's all part. It's important when things don't go well. When things go well, I don't think it matters. But when things don't go well, you then need a partnership with that patient. Whether they're unhappy with a diffractive optic IOL, whether you got a refractive surprise, whether they have a serious surgical complication, your ability to deal with the relationship with the patient makes it better for them, better for you, less chair time, and less risk of, you know, medical legal action or things of that nature.
What are some pearls for us? The majority of our Cataract Coach fans and podcast listeners are actually ophthalmologists in their 30s and 40s.
Yes.
So what are some pearls in dealing with a patient who has complications after surgery or has that refractive surprise and they're not happy?
Well, the most important thing is a very careful pre-op evaluation of the patient. I like to say that if the patient, let's say, for example, a patient has an epiretinal membrane and you've not discussed it, not determined it, not discussed it, and post-op, and you've put in a diffractive optic IOL, post-op they're not seeing well, and you have an unhappy person, and then you discover, oh, patient has macular pucker. Patient had it preoperatively. If you told that to the patient, then it's their problem. If you didn't tell that to the patient, then it's your problem. So very often, people will miss particularly ocular surface disease, dry eye problems, things of that nature, and they may miss some subtle macular disease. So even though you may not be reimbursed for doing a MAC OCT on everyone or everyone you're considering for, let's say, a premium type or a presbyopic type of IOL, it's worth the time to do it.
Sure.
It's worth your time to evaluate it. So the most important thing is to know everything you can about that patient and let the patient be your partner. You know, Mrs. Jones, I don't think you're a good candidate for X, Y, or Z lens because you have this comorbidity. And I think that's important for the patient to know. So once you've established that you know what's going on with them, they feel better.
Yeah.
And any problem that does come up because of it, you're then a team. You're not adversarial. You never want to be adversarial with a patient in trouble. I mean, that's
a great point. I used to teach the residents, if you predict something ahead of time, you have an ERM, you may get macular edema after surgery, you're a smart doctor for predicting it. But if you don't tell them, you're a bad doctor for causing the problem.
Exactly. It's the same thing. It's either their problem or your problem, depending upon what you do as a physician. So the time you spend with a patient preoperatively is going to save you so much chair time postoperatively if you're aware of the issue and the patient will know what can happen. Another thing I would advise young people, I don't know where it ever came to be that cataract surgery, or any surgery for that matter, was a horse race. When it comes to, you know, maybe cardiac, thoracic, or even abdominal surgery, yeah, the longer the patient's under, sure, the more things can go wrong, what have you. But in cataract surgery, the difference between 2 minutes or 3 minutes intraoperatively, the time that you save with dealing with postoperative problems by spending an extra minute or so in surgery doing it carefully. I always tried to make every case perfect.
Of course.
And I never did. I always said, maybe I could have done this a little bit, maybe I could have done that a little better. But that was the idea. I was challenging myself. Oh, one other thing, all right? As you gain a reputation, supposing you're really talented, you're building a very big practice, patients are beating down the door to get to you, remember this. You're only as good as the next person for whom you care, all right? Forget your press clippings, all right?
You can't rest on your laurels. It's the next case.
It's exactly. You're only as good as the next patient for whom you care.
So our Cataract Coach fans will realize that a lot of what Dr. Maskett says, you've heard me say before. Where do you think I learned it from? Hello.
He plagiarized it.
Borrowed.
Yeah, okay.
These are amazing points. In fact, one of the things you said went very quickly, but let's repeat it. You don't want the patient to feel like they're an adversary to you. You have to be on the same team. And that is so critical, especially if there are complications post-op.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's most true. But one thing we also didn't talk about here is consumerism. When you're doing insurance-based cataract surgery, where there's no decision the patient's going to have, well, you've discussed with them whether they want distance or what have you, but it's a monofocal lens. You're not doing femtosecond laser, you're not doing intraoperative aberrometry. No money is changing hands for the surgery other than the third-party payer, the insurance-based. There's a different mindset on the part of the patient. Once the patient reaches into their pocket and they're paying for whatever service or device that you're providing, they've become consumers. Mm-hmm. And that's a very, very different relationship. So bear in mind that if they're not happy, they say, well, I've paid you X thousands of dollars for this, and I'm not, you know, I can't see 2010 and J1 Plus under all lighting conditions, you know, day or night, and the colors are perfect, and I never see reflection. Some may say a patient's entitled to feel that way. I don't know if that's true, but some do feel that. They feel entitled because of their money. So bear that in mind. And I think, by the way, that consumerism also keeps a lot of surgeons from using toric lenses, which is really a shame because patients really benefit from toric lenses.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Right. So I think some surgeons either don't want to go down that road and deal with the expectations and the entitlement that patients may feel. But the point you raise about a team, that's why I always feel I remember seeing a patient one day post-op from a multifocal, and everything was perfect. I mean, everything was perfect. She was 20/15, J1, and I said to her, I'm going to have to take that lens out. Because not only did she tell me about halos, she told me what she saw inside the halos.
I didn't know there was stuff in the halos.
Well, she did. So she brought me a litany of description of what she was seeing one day post-op. And it took her 3 years to finally say, you're right, I have to take that lens out. But we were a team all the time. We were a team. And so I've never forgotten her because I explained what was going on. She was willing to listen. She was willing to learn. She was willing to live with it. But after 3 years, she said, okay, I'm done. And then, well, it was a little more challenging taking that lens out. And while we're on that subject, all right, removing IOLs is much less difficult than people think.
Sure.
You just have to use basic surgical principles, be patient, understand why the lens is stuck, how to unstick it. And by and large, you can remove, I mean, even 10 years out, you can remove lenses. And on that subject, we published just recently a paper on the prognosis postoperatively for patients who had open versus closed capsules in exchanging IOLs just for optical considerations, dysphotopic, wrong power, opaque IOLs, no pathology. And we found that the postoperative complication rate was identical.
Oh, whether or not they had prior capsulotomy.
Yes, exactly.
Wow.
The only significant difference between the two groups is that in the patients who had open capsules, well, they wound up with lenses that were either captured or in the sulcus with iris suture fixation. We were less accurate in their optical outcomes. We had myopic errors in those patients, rather than the ones with the closed capsule bag-to-bag exchange. But we didn't have an increased complication rate. If you know how to manage
that's so interesting. I would not have predicted that.
No one would have predicted it. But we did that study because over the years, I've taken care of so many people sent to me unhappy with multifocals. After, of course, the first thing the surgeon does is assume the capsule is the problem.
And yag them.
Right, yag them. And so I got accustomed, and we developed a protocol for how to do it. And I wish I could give you the numbers. That paper is just out in JCRS.
But what are some of your protocols for preventing, let's say, vitreous prolapse as you're dissecting or taking the old lens out?
There isn't you have to do a vitrectomy.
Yeah.
And you have.
Are you doing it pars plana or limbal approach?
Most often it's pars plana. It depends upon, you have to play it as it lies.
So cutter, pars plana, infusion at the limbus?
Yes, most typically. I'll give you an alternative example. I had a patient who was sent to me with a very, very bad Z syndrome with a crystal lens. And she'd already had her anterior and posterior capsule, I mean, lased out to her. You could barely see them. There was vitreous all around.
Oh, boy.
But the lens was really blocking access. So I did that as an anterior approach.
Mm.
Took out the vitreous that way. Of course, assisted by stain with triamcinolone. Then you have to cut those lenses out and then do a little more anterior vitrectomy. But then she wound up with a sulcus-placed three-piece silicone IOL sewn to the iris, and she did great.
Probably LI-61?
Yes. That's your go-to fastball? Oh, that's a fastball. That's a great sulcus lens.
So you got to play it as it lies. You don't know
the
approach.
By the way, it is the only IOL that is approved for sulcus implantation in this country.
Oh, I did not know that.
The only IOL, that's right. It's labeled for sulcus implantation.
So 6mm silicon optic,
yes.
Zero spherical aberration, and
yes.
Then slight tilt of the haptic optic junction, a little angulation.
Exactly.
Oh. So you put it, if there's good sulcus support, you still suture to the iris so it doesn't rattle around?
Exactly. When people say to me, well, I just put it in the sulcus, I said, in time it'll decenter, and if it moves, it'll chafe. You really want to fixate it. If you can't do optic capture, which is the best way to manage it, then we suture the haptics to the iris. And I always say, you'll see. And and it's pretty much true. They'll move. You know, unfortunately, we lost our 14mm
lens, the star,
yeah, with the 6.3 optic. That was a great device for the sulcus. And those, I don't think you always had to suture those, because those 14mm haptic.
Bigger.
Yeah, those were on the low power lenses. That was the AQ5010V series. Crime, we lost that. Yeah, it was a great series, the 2010 and the 5010.
So, wow, you've done a lot of publications in this space that are really changed the way we operate. Like, one of my favorites from you is recently is dead bag syndrome.
Oh, God.
Which is a whole other topic. Any pros there? And why are we seeing more and more of this seemingly?
I think you just asked the most important question. You know, I think of this almost in a way like HORV. I mean, for years we were either infusing
hemorrhagic occlusive retinal vasculitis.
Right. If you've never seen a case, you don't want to.
Yeah.
It's disastrous to have to routine surgery to see the retina just destroyed by HORV, ostensibly due to intraocular vanc. So many eyes had vanc for so many years, was never seen. I don't know why something changed and all.
Maybe the way they prepared the vancomycin?
We don't know.
Yeah.
We don't know. And, you know, there's the smoking gun there, but there still isn't an absolute. I don't think Koch's postulates all right, were fulfilled. Now, we're facing a very similar thing with the dead bag. I described that term when I first saw a patient easily 20 years ago, if not more, wherein I noticed that the capsule leaflets didn't fuse. And that the capsule, the anterior capsule, instead of undergoing that fibrometaplastic change and become white, it looked as though you just did the surgery. And I watched that patient for a number of years, stayed that way. But that patient had a white mature cataract. And so I thought maybe there was some oncotic damage to the LECs, killed the LECs, and that's why that bag stayed that way. Then a few years later, I was sent, in fact, it was a cardiologist who had a dead bag that, you know, wasn't a white cataract in the beginning, and it was just, the bag was just disintegrating. So, you know, maybe 20 and 15 years ago, I saw only a couple of cases. And then I started to see a couple more. And so I spoke to a few colleagues about it. Jason Jones got really excited about it. A couple of other people, maybe Alan Crandall. And all of a sudden, they started seeing patients. Now, it's like a hot topic.
Right.
Everyone wants to get on it. You didn't let me in on your paper. So let me just, for those of you who aren't familiar, haven't seen a dead bag, this is a situation which a long-term post-operative patient has a capsule that looks almost virginal, as though you just did the surgery, but the capsule starts to degenerate. And if it degenerates in the periphery, the zonular fibers go along with it, the lens will decenter. If it degenerates more centrally or at the equator or what have you, the haptics will start to feed through the bag. So the bag disintegrates with or without the zonular apparatus. Nobody knows the cause. It's been seen with every type of lens out there. Just recently a case came back to us. I operated on this man in the mid-1990s.
Oh, wow, long ago.
And came back to Nicole for lens exchange. So it's almost 30 years ago this patient had surgery. What we don't know is whether the patient had a normal post-operative response, they developed some PCO or they developed some capsule fibrosis, and then it went away, the cells died over years, or if the patient looked like that from day one, where they never developed. We don't know. This patient that I did 30 years ago, I don't think this patient had intracameral antibiotics. Maybe he did. We're working very hard to get those records. And I hope we do, because some people have said, well, maybe it's intracameral anesthetic, intracameral antibiotics. I'm trying to look and see whether I did him I started topical probably about 94.
Yeah, you taught me topical.
Yeah, so he was done a little bit after that.
For sure.
I don't know whether he was topical, whether he had intracameral antibiotics, intracameral anesthetic.
Is there an age-related thing, too? Is the older patients more likely?
Absolutely not.
No?
No. Back to the... So I think there are two types.
Sure.
There's the white cataract in which there may have been, a dilutional death, so to speak, aqueous imbibed, killing those LECs. I did a young woman's surgery maybe 9 or 10 years ago in her young 30s. She had that white cataract. She was done routinely. Her capsule has never changed since the first day. But her lens hasn't decentered either.
Interesting.
So, yeah. Her fellow eye was not white, had a PSC or something, and that underwent the usual post-operative changes where you see a subcapsular LEC proliferation. And bear in mind, I clean LECs extensively. I'm a firm believer in that.
And capsule polishing.
Right, that's what I say, yeah. And the reason, a lot of reasons I do that, but having done that, I don't think that's the cause. Because here's a young woman, one eye, dead bag, one eye live bag, but she had a white cataract in the dead bag.
So we'll keep an eye out then for these dead bags in our patients. If I have one, I promise I'll refer them to you just so you can add it to your database.
Well, the other thing what we're doing is we're working with Liliana Werner. Nick Mamlis up at Utah. You know, that's where the real pathology of IOLs is centered.
Sure.
And what they do is really tremendous up there. So Liliana keeps the more specimens we send, and I said it's like it's an epidemic, and I don't know why they're all of a sudden showing up. Although, when you increase awareness of a condition, all of a sudden you find
it.
You find it exactly.
For sure.
It may be that, just like the HORB thing.
Sure.
Right.
Tell me a little bit more about your pathway and ultimately your journey.
Yeah.
I know you trained on the East Coast and something about California tracked you over. How did that all go?
Oh, God. You know, I always feel guilty in not having a specific set of plans to how I was going to run my life, all right? Either personally or professionally.
Sure.
To a great extent, I've let life happen to me. I trained in New York, and in fact, my chief was one of the very, very first implanters in the United States.
Of IOLs?
Yeah, of IOLs. So I saw them as a resident. So we're talking, I was a resident from 69 to 73.
So a lot of our young ophthalmologists may not know,
right.
There were huge controversies about putting IOLs in eyes.
Right.
Huge.
Massive. But my passion actually in those days, or it morphed when I was a senior resident, into strabismus, because we had this fascinating orthoptist who had trained at Columbia Presbyterian, where Phil Knapp, now probably nobody knows who Phil Knapp was. There was a time when there were four really major strabismus programs in the United States. There was Gunter von Norden in Houston, there was Marshall Parks in Washington, and Art Jampolsky on the West Coast, and Phil Knapp in New York. They were the four horsemen. She had trained, Columbia had a very big orthoptic program that he oversaw, and she got me excited about strabismus, and I went and spent 6 months with him.
Wow.
And I just loved it. I just loved it. So I then had to do 2 years in the military. My second year was in Philadelphia, where we had a training program. And because I had power, all the strabismus cases from the surrounding small clinics were referred in. So the residents, they were doing 6-8 strabismus cases a week.
Wow, that's a big volume.
I had a lot of experience. By serendipity, we took a vacation to California, and I went to Big Sur, and I said, oh my God, this is the most beautiful place in the world.
It's gorgeous.
And I said, what the hell is wrong with me? Why am I living in New Jersey? So we moved. We
just
moved
like that.
Stock and barrel. With 6 and 8-year-old boys, a friend of mine out here found me, said, there's somebody out in the valley who wants to leave. He has a part-time practice. It's only 2 years old. He opened a few practices when he finished, and he wants to get rid of this office. You go there. I said, okay. So I paid him $4,000 for his phone and his records and his furniture, right? Not his equipment. And I opened the office wanting to do strabismus.
Sure.
Because I had just come out of the military. And that was my passion. But I didn't have training in pediatric ophthalmology. I just had extra training in strabismus. And the local pediatric ophthalmologist told all the pediatricians that it was malpractice to send the patient to me. He was a little bit aggressive. A little bit aggressive. So even though I was teaching it at the Stein, I was scrubbing with the residents on strabismus cases. Actually, I was mostly at the VA in those days, the Wadsworth VA, when I first came out. And I had some, Tony Arnold's one of my residents,
sure.
I had some terrific people who I was working with. And I just wasn't getting really, I was building a general practice, but I couldn't get the strabismic referrals that I wanted. Well, right around that time, this is the late 70s, one of my mentors is a man by the name of Murray Weber, who was, I don't know if you ever knew Murray. Murray was the first one in California to do implants.
Oh.
He, in 77 or so, he got a phaco machine at West Hills Hospital, where I was working. And I saw,
this is before any university had a phaco machine.
Right, and I saw what he was doing. I said, this is exciting. And it happened to be that this is the epicenter, or particularly Orange County, but Southern California, is the epicenter for all innovative cataract surgical tools. I mean, all IOLs were essentially made in Southern California, phaco machines, all of this stuff. So I watched Murray, and I started to get fascinated by it, got involved with some of the companies, and then went to watch Dick Kratz.
Sure.
And he was a master not only at doing phaco, he was a master at everything. I went fishing with him. He fished like he did phaco. Every movement was
a ballet. It was a ballet.
It was elegant. It really was. So he became a hero, and he became a mentor. And so I learned to do phaco maybe 79 or so, around that time, and started doing it then. Now, because at that time, fewer than 5% of surgeons were doing phaco, the companies would bring machines to me to
sure.
try and what have you. And I got involved in teaching phaco. Believe it or not, we had to teach YAG lasers in those days. There was somebody, probably nobody knows, there was an ophthalmologist down in Orange County named Bill Maloney. Bill Maloney had also learned phaco from Dick Kratz, but Bill was a very shrewd guy. He could systematize anything. So he developed a program, a teaching program called Three Steps to Phaco.
Yeah, for sure.
Three Steps to Phaco. And he had it down to such a great series of steps on how to do this. And he put together a faculty where we would go around maybe at least once, if not twice a month, to different cities on weekends teaching phaco.
Wow.
We'd have wet labs and we'd have lectures. And there was a certain faculty that came together to do this. Howard Fine was among them.
Sure.
Jim Davison was among them. David Dillman was among them. Mark Michelson was among them. Ultimately, Sherry Rowan joined the crowd. Alan Crandall joined the crowd. I don't want to leave anybody out, but I probably am. Bill Fishkind was involved in this. And we would come and we would watch each other teach and talk
nice.
About it. We couldn't wait till the next meeting to see who's taking it to the next level.
Oh.
So we became a group very similar. If you're familiar with Malcolm Gladwell's Outliers,
sure.
This was a group who all were very similar in age, all working in a similar environment, stimulating each other to raise that state
keep raising
of
the bar.
And that's what we did. And that's how all the small pupil stuff came about. With Bobby Osher's input, that's where the astigmatism managed.
Sure.
That's where the zonular stuff came about. So while Osher didn't like what we were doing, he didn't think we should be teaching people who couldn't learn to do it, but the innovative stuff he was doing, we incorporated
sure.
into the curriculum. Because we all learned from Bobby as
of
well.
Of course, of course.
So this group, plus Bobby, are just like an outlier where the opportunity was there, we saw it, and we stimulated each other, and then we stimulated the industry to make better machines and better tools.
So you just kept advancing it higher and higher.
And that's why we have the MSTs, and that's why we have
sure.
all the laser companies. There's a marriage of technology and technician that's just, it's unmatched in cataract. I mean, you think about, I was doing intracaps as a resident. I was doing intracaps and when I was first in practice, and then extracap and onto phaco. But think about that. We're talking about intracaps without lenses and with lenses to what we do today.
Yeah.
And it's all within the span of my professional lifetime. It's
a lot of advance in a very short time.
But it happened because of this marriage, what I call the surgical industrial complex, from the better part of that terminology.
What's interesting about this too is that it's private practice doctors working with the industry.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people would think that no, it'd be more on the academic side. But it seemed like at the time, at least the academic side was quite lagging.
The academic side was lagging for two reasons. Number one, tradition. What we do is best.
We've always done it this way.
Exactly.
We can't change.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And also, as an example, there was a time when I was working with Arthur Rosenbaum, who was chief
sure.
of pediatric ophthalmology at UCLA, to do the pediatric implants. Arthur got became very clairvoyant that this was the way to manage pediatric cataract. And I had done some of these, so I wound up working with him. It took us a year and a half to get approval of the Human Subject Protection Committee at UCLA to do this, where I was doing this in my practice.
Right.
So universities can have a lot of bureaucracy that slow things down, along with an attitudinal, you know, sense. Most of the major things in ophthalmology and cataracts.
Certainly
in
cataract,
yeah. Well, look at Charlie Kelman.
I mean, of course.
He was damned by the academic institutions. I mean, femto the same way. I mean, I can't think of too many things that actually came out of academics in cataract. Probably none of them. OVDs did. I mean, they did come out of Harvard. Yeah, because that's where David Miller and Robert Stegman. Stegman was a fellow there at Mass Eye and Ear. So I'll give Mass Eye and Ear, and that's where Balazs was as well. So I'll give Mass Eye and Ear the credit for OVDs.
For sure.
But most things have come out of the private sector.
Right, I just want to tell our young audience that no matter what you do in your practice, you can end up in a complete private practice in a small town somewhere, you can have an impact in ophthalmology globally. Mm-hmm. Despite you being a solo practitioner in a small town.
It all depends where your passion is.
Right.
Again, as we spoke before, many younger people they want a work-life balance. Ophthalmology may not be their passion. Not everyone, you know, has to have, you know, needs to be crazy about cataracts as you
like
and
us.
I might. No, I mean, you know, it maybe is to a certain extent a disease that we have. As I was saying off camera before, during the heydays of my practice, I didn't appreciate entertainment. I would sit in a movie. I would sit at the opera, sit at a play, and think about eyeballs.
I
remember coming up with a variety of things during, in fact, going to concerts at Ambassador Auditorium in Pasadena. That's where the L.A. Chamber Orchestra used to play. I love chamber music, but I would sit there and think about eyeballs.
So we're cuckoo for cataracts.
Yeah, and if you are,
yeah,
the sky's the limit. You can do what you want to do. I used to keep in my freezer, I had a bag of cow eyes and pig eyes, all sorts of stuff that I could, at the end of a day, I could go and practice this and try that, so that I never did a procedure on a patient that was the first time I was doing that procedure. I mean, my boys thought I was weird.
Yeah, I can imagine. You may have scared them away from ophthalmology, yeah. Sam.
We always had a bag of eyeballs in my freezer.
I haven't gone that far yet, but I do use the model eyes.
Oh, yeah, but you've got the Simuli, that wonderful device that Stuart Stoll makes. So,
you
don't need a freezer full of eyeballs.
How did you get to be in LA, your practice in LA, how did you get to be known as the go-to guy for a tough case, and how did you develop that?
I think what happened, I don't like to use words that extol me in any way.
Sure.
But I think I developed prominence because I always believed in publishing.
Sure.
When I was a resident, I published 10 papers. It was something.
So I was a resident?
As a resident. I think that was something that somehow that was to me the highest level thing you could do is publish. That may be, you know, not important today. Maybe it wasn't important. It was important to me.
Sure.
So I published a lot. So people, and I published related to cataract eventually. So I had that name, and then I would present at, I would get involved in ASCRS. And so I was put on the editorial board. The next thing that happened was they asked me to take the consultation section. So of JCRS. So I was doing it once a month. I was doing them all 12 issues. And so they were always complex cases, and people knew that I was interested in complex surgery. So I got a reputation for being interested in that, not necessarily being able to fix it, but being interested in it. But then by my association with that other group of what I call outliers.
Sure.
And I really want to credit Bobby Osher, even though we didn't like that we were teaching people, but we incorporated a lot of what he taught. So I learned by watching my fellow colleagues every month we'd go someplace and, you know, watch, you know, Howard Fine deal with a broken capsule, or watch this one deal with vitreous prolapse. And so we all learned from one another how to manage problems.
Yeah, that's been accelerated now. Now the neat part is, can you imagine? People can watch an HD video on their phone from anywhere on the planet and learn how to do a case.
And that's, and you nailed it from the standpoint of why cataract lends itself so well to teaching. It's because of the microscope and video.
Yeah. Well, we've got HD video. Mm-hmm. We've got, like, for cataract coach, I put up a new video every day now. Today's day 1,765 or something. So it's just like, and there's no stopping. There will be a new video every day as long as I'm alive, as long as I can still do it. But I think the amount of learning we do from each other, people are almost surprised. I say that I learn more from making those videos than I teach.
You raise a very good point. I always, always tell people when they're new in practice, and forever, always video your surgery. If it's a routine case, you may not care to watch it, but anything that's abnormal, you're going to learn when you look at that video.
For sure.
And particularly for teaching and what have you. So I videoed every case in my career. And, you know, as I said, I didn't always review them if it was routine. But, you know, in doing a lot of teaching, you're always looking for certain examples of X, Y, or Z. And as you say, you learn so much by watching yourself operate.
Yeah, of course. Right?
And you learn so much by watching yourself in trouble and how you handled it and what other opportunities you might have. And while we're talking about OVDs, that's a great thing about OVD, because it buys you time and it buys you space. So you can sit back. If you're in a complex situation, some OVD in the eye, say, what am I going to do next?
As I say, viscoelastic is cheaper than vitreous.
Yeah.
One of my favorites.
Yeah, or it's always better to leave a little cortex than remove a little vitreous.
I like that one, too.
And by the way, while we're talking about OVD, of all of the quote-unquote miracles in ophthalmology, what the industry has given to us, none is more important than the OVD.
Sure.
We could still all be doing extra cap. We could still all be putting contact lens instead of implants. But if we didn't have OVDs, we wouldn't have the corneas we have today.
Right. Sure. Yeah. Lots of endothelial loss.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, OVDs have come a long way since the old days of HPMC, hydroxyprolymethylcellulose.
Yeah.
So neat stuff. And another analogy you gave earlier was about, like, the athletes. Yeah, athletes watch game day footage. How can you do surgery and not record the cases?
Right.
Because, again, you can't predict when something will happen. And then the only way to learn from it is to go back and watch the game day footage and say, okay, you know what, I should have done this, that, and the other differently.
Exactly.
So, yeah. And it's what you said. It's just the goal of, I want to perfect every surgery. I want that Rex so pretty that you can't even tell where it started or finished. And it's that kind of mental drive to make sure every case is that beautiful. Right.
And it may not bear heavily on the outcome of that case, but it makes you a better surgeon.
Right.
So the skills you develop, you will use in a complex or complicated situation.
Right. If you can become 1% better
right.
a week, 1.01 to the power of 52, right. That's a pretty huge improvement over the course of a year.
I have no doubt.
Yeah. So, but yeah, I think the other part is learning from colleagues and seeing other people in trouble and getting out of complications. There was a saying, one I'm stealing from someone, not sure who, but he said, there are only two types of doctors who don't get complications. Those who don't operate, and those who lie about it.
You know, it's funny. I remember I was so nervous my first live surgery.
Sure.
I was in Germany. Maybe this is 91 or something like that. And I go to this meeting. It was in some northern Germany. I can't recall at the moment, where they used to have the U-boats in World War II. And there was a wonderful guy and a great surgeon, named Peter Brauweiler from Germany. Peter unfortunately passed away young, smoked like crazy, and died of lung cancer. But Peter, in surgery, had a complication. He broke a capsule. And here's the live surgeon saying, oh, my God, this... And he was operating before I was. And now I'm really nervous. Now I'm really... And he handled it beautifully. He handled the... And he said he was very happy that this occurred intraoperatively, sure. So that the audience, so to speak, the other doctors there, would learn how to manage it. They don't need to see routine cases.
Right.
I wanted them to see routine cases.
Well, I also did live surgery in more than a dozen countries.
Yeah.
All over. It's stressful. Some people may not know, when you're doing live surgery, you've got in one earpiece, your moderator trying to talk to you, hopefully about the step you're doing, not a different step you're doing. In your other earpiece, you have the director saying, okay, move your hand or set up the microscope.
Well, I describe doing that kind of surgery, live surgery, I call it an away game. And it's an away game.
Yeah, someone else's
just
OR.
Just like the basketball floor bounces differently or something like that. Things, the lighting is different. The scope is different. The chairs are different. And again, there's so much going on. You got somebody talking in your ear. It's, you know, some people don't believe in it. They say it's, you know, it's like throwing the Christians to the lions. But people want to see you fail. They want to see you have a problem.
Well, it's like going to a car crash, going to a car race. You wouldn't mind seeing a crash as long as seriously hurt.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I don't know if they're doing a lot of. It's very expensive to do live surgery. I don't think they're doing it very much anymore. Yeah.
The other thing you have to, when you're in that host country, you got to figure out in the local language, how do you say "look at the light"? Yeah. I still remember being in Italy and asking, how do you say this? So I could interrupt by saying, signora, por favore, guarda la luce. Eh?
You know, per favore in Italian.
Oh, per favore.
Sì, è vero.
Guarda la luce.
I learned how to operate in Russian, Vietnamese, you know, all these languages. But I'll tell you, it was a little bit different. I had one experience. This was remarkable. It was down in southern India. I think it was in Madurai. And they lined up a whole series of like bridge chairs, and patients were sitting up. They were all dilated, and they gave me a flashlight, and I'm going around trying to find what I think is an appropriate case for teaching, right? And if I said yes, immediately behind me was somebody with a syringe to give
a block.
A block in the chair. Patient sitting in the chair. I said yes. Wham. That wasn't thinking about the patient first. That's not the kind of relationship we were talking about earlier.
Yeah,
about
different.
Know your patient.
And, yeah. You've had some wild adventures, and you've probably taught surgery in 50, 60, 70 countries.
Well, you know, also, since I did a lot of Zooms also.
Sure.
And all over. I mean, I've got another Zoom coming up in Syria this week. So, you know, it's really remarkable how Zoom came along at the same time as a pandemic.
Sure.
You talk about a match made in heaven.
Yeah.
And look what Ike Ahmed did with Zooms in the beginning,
oh,
in the beginning of the
stuff.
Pandemic, all over the world. So, I no longer know how many countries in which I've taught. But yeah, I've done surgery in lots and lots of places. And I think and it's the same thing about taking care of either complex patients. Some patients are complex, even if their eye isn't. A complex patient, a VIP, a complex problem, family member, what have you. If you can focus your attention, it's you and that eyeball.
Sure.
Everything else is peripheral. And it's the same way you approach guest surgery. It's you and that eyeball.
Just kind of compartmentalized.
Exactly. Compartmentalized. You've set the patient up. Surgical ergonomics is everything. Patient's in a comfortable position. You're in a comfortable position. Then it's just you and that eyeball, and you deal with those issues, and you forget whether it's, you know, an A-lister or your mother or whatever.
It's just the eye.
Exactly.
So kind of get in that state of flow. Block out everything else,
exactly.
Get in that state of flow, and just focus
right. And
on
and that's
the
mental aspect. That's like the inner game of cataract surgery.
Sure.
Right. Don't ever think of anything else but that eyeball when you're operating.
Oh, for sure. I'm even old-fashioned. I don't even play music anymore. I like it quiet. Focus only on the task at hand.
Well, I over the years, I would change the music. I played the music of the patient's youth.
Oh, how smart is that?
I started with playing big band.
Oh, because, of course.
Yeah, because they were. So, let's talk about the greatest generation,
sure.
Right? Those people.
Yeah.
Or maybe older than that, they listened to big band music, World War II type music, that kind of stuff. And I played that for a number of years. Then we gradually, you know, moved on up to Clapton or what have you. I never got to hip hop.
Not there yet.
That wasn't the patient base. One of our colleagues, a Russian surgeon, played Russian disco music in the room. Thumpa, thumpa.
And at a very loud volume.
Yes, and I couldn't understand that.
Yeah, I don't get it at all either. I was raised in a library as a kid, so I just like it quiet.
What about operating with lights on or off?
I leave them on.
Yeah.
I
did for a long time. I don't... So at some point I changed. I thought lights off were better. I think it is better. better contrast.
Yeah, I just never really noticed the difference. I just tend to keep them on. Where do we go next, Nelson? What's coming down the pipe? What's coming down the pipeline for us?
Okay, well, as
hopefully accommodating lenses.
Okay, are you talking about technique or technology?
Both, yeah. Anything.
Again, I'm looking for, and if I knew what it was, I'd be a genius. I'm looking for the next phase of cataract surgery that doesn't look like what we do now. Whether you have a laser or some automated device that makes orexis and does, you know, nuclear removal or division or what have you, it's still basically the same type of surgery we've done for a number of years. The holy grail has always been the concept of emptying the bag through a small opening and filling it with a polymer that is clear and accommodating. And, we've been talking about that for 40 years, and it hasn't materialized. I think that technology may come, but what I'm thinking is, as we alluded to before, more and more automation, maybe fewer and fewer ophthalmologists and technicians, optometrists, or some other willing provider, because as you say, we're 4 million lens-based surgeries now. If you look at the demographics, in this country right now, you've got about 60 million people between 55 and 85. That's going to go to 90 million by 2030.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
by 2030. That's in 10 years.
Yeah, that's right. So just think about that. These cataracts are going to go up by 60%.
Wow.
Yeah.
So like 6-7 million cataracts in a year.
Oh, absolutely. And ophthalmologists who are retiring early because they got musculoskeletal problems, because they're burned out. You know, the society has to start caring about physicians. The relationships have changed radically because, you know, in the old days, the doctors were driving Cadillacs and they were driving Mercedes. Now they're driving Bentleys. People don't cry for the doctors.
Sure.
We don't have that relationship with the patient. And we need the patients to be our advocates. Not only over years, we've been the patient advocates. We need patients to be our advocates because burnout and other wellness issues are going to really take us.
How do we rebuild that?
Oh, that's very, very difficult. It's so difficult to rebuild that because medicine's been dehumanized.
Right.
This private equity business or other ownership of practices. You take a look around L.A. and you see all the buildings that now have UCLA on their name or Cedars on their name. So it's no longer a doctor and a patient. It's a corporation and a patient.
Yeah.
And the corporation has providers. Greed is at the center of it all. Bottom line, economics. I always felt that medicine should be excluded from that relationship, but we're now just a microcosm of the greed that you see in this country.
Yeah, I always thought it was strange, like when, you know, decades ago, it was just universities were centrally located, and that's where you sent the zebra cases, the unusual cases.
Right.
Now the universities have crept out with satellites out in the community,
right,
hiring new grads, paying them below market rate, just right, so they can, and even the patients. You ask the patient, well, who did your surgery? They say, oh, this hospital. I mean, no, which surgeon? Oh, I don't know, just that hospital.
Right, exactly.
I don't even know.
Exactly. So, I don't know how that's going to change, but it's very evident to me that more and more technology is going to replace the traditional physician.
Sure.
I don't know how you're going to get, you know, when you get far enough down the line, how are you going to get the people who really can handle the problems if they've never been there before? I don't know, but I think we're moving toward mass treatment. That's why you have everything is now, if it's not been proven in the literature, everything is kind of cookbook medicine. And the physician judgment, I'm not sure it's as good as doing evidence-based medicine. But evidence-based medicine, if the study isn't designed properly, doesn't give the right answer. I've seen too much evidence for that. But that's where we're going.
But you're right, it's not all protocols. They just say, okay, patient has this, here's the criteria, here's the analysis, here's this, follow this path. And the physician judgment almost doesn't play a role.
Right. And there's a lot of question. There's a lot of question whether physician judgment is superior to evidence-based medicine. And it's all based on what the subject is. It's not just you know, in general. You can't generalize anything. Everything's individual. So I think we're moving toward more technology, fewer physicians, and again, maybe any willing provider. I think we're going to wind up training, if not in this country, in other countries, particularly countries like China, although they can probably develop enough ophthalmologists rapidly enough, but they can train young people to do cataract surgery and handle their cataract blindness.
But even, yeah, some of these, you know, MSICS cataract camps, they're training non-ophthalmologists, basically, to just be a master of that one procedure.
So I said you'd make one-trick ponies. Just as an example, in the UK, for years, nurses have done laser capsulotomies.
Oh, I didn't know.
Oh, yeah. And tell me, you couldn't teach a high school kid to do a laser capsulotomy?
It's the first thing you teach a brand new first-year resident. July of your first-year residency, let me teach you how to do a YAG capsulotomy.
Right. So, I mean, so you don't need to spend 13 years in training, as Tom points out, to learn how to do that. So the nurses, you know, in the NHS system, it's all about economics.
Sure.
And time and volume and what have you. So nurses are trained to do YAG lasers.
And all the intravitreal injections, too.
Are they doing them as well?
Yes, because that's just an injection, right? Nurses can do an injection. It just happens to be in your eye, in your vitreous.
So,
but maybe we'll have like the UK then, where 93% of patients use the Nationalized Health Service and 7% do boutique pay out of pocket.
Well, you raise a very important subject, and that is our, we have the most convoluted healthcare delivery system in the world. And we have a de facto two-tier system now, where you mentioned concierge medicine. We are going to a two-tier system. There's no question. As I see the future for Medicare, and people can stare and throw daggers at me, we're going to what they call Medicare Advantage for all, eventually.
So Medicare HMO, basically.
An HMO concept where everyone will be covered, but it's going to be the Advantage type. It's not going to be the fee-for-service type. And you'll lose physicians that way. You'll have more technicians. You'll have physician assistants. You'll have nurse practitioners. That's how I see the future. How else to be frank? You have an aging society. You have an explosion of technology. We're already, 18-19% of GDP, and not everyone's getting care.
Correct.
So how else are you going to care for an aging, growing population? You have to have universal health care. Physicians don't like to hear this, and I'm glad my career is done.
You're already out. You're done.
But this is what I see the future, and I don't know when the future is going to happen. But to not have health care for all is absurd to me. It's crazy.
Yeah.
It's crazy. I mean, I'm not a Bernie Sanders fan, but I agree with him on that one.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
The tough part, too, is that you look at some of the, you know, the lobbying that pharma does, it's so effective, like just an intravitreal injection. The retina specialist with 14 years of training gets $100 to do the injection. The drug itself is $1,900. That's a 95% to 5% split.
Right, and there are new programs now that are designed with these equivalent drugs or what have you, where the retina surgeon is not going to make the money on the drugs. The patient's going to buy the drug and bring it to the retina surgeon, or it's going to be delivered to the pharmacy or what have you, to where the surgeon's being taken out of that formula. Back to the situation of having a two-tiered system. So ultimately, we're going to have a Medicare for all at some point down the road. It'll be managed care type, and then a lot of people who have money will opt out. And I don't know if the physicians, like today, I opted out of Medicare for the last number of years of my practice. Whether you'll be allowed to do it, whether you have to give a certain amount of time to public care, I don't know.
Oh, wow.
Well, that happens in some countries. You must practice public medicine a certain amount of time, either a certain number of years or a certain number of hours, and then you can practice private medicine. Yeah.
Wow, that's a big ask, especially when you're asking those 13 years of training. I mean, for 8 of them, you're paying hundreds of thousands of dollars in tuition.
In those countries, the most of those physicians are trained in public schools. I mean, here we have this really absurd dichotomy of people going $500,000 in debt to go for their education, and then to work in corporate medicine and you know, have little to no chance of paying that back. I mean, we're in a crisis in this country in terms of medicine. I mean, the burnout is a real problem. And the most significant contributing factor to burnout is loss of physician autonomy.
Oh, totally agree with you there.
Yes.
Dealing with the bureaucracy, the admin, the grief, that has nothing to do actually with patient care.
I'll tell you, this came home, this has stayed with me, and I've told this story a lot. My wife, Barbara, needed an orthopedic procedure or back surgery. And she had to see someone to do her pre-op, not her regular doctor. So there's somebody that the group uses.
Okay.
So she goes to see this guy, and this seems like a very nice man. They're starting this conversation. And he's older. And at some point, he laments to her that he used to have a practice and took care of people and on and on. And now all he's doing is clicking his way through life with the EMR system.
Click, click, click.
That's all. He's clicking his way through life. That hit me like a ton of bricks. We always worked with scribes. So when we did paper charts, I had a scribe write the notes. And then when we went to EMR, we still have scribes who make the entries so that you can deal with the patient. You can also see more patients,
sure,
by the way. So I always believe very, very firmly in Doom. But what has happened to physicians just looking at a computer screen and not the patient, it's horrible for both. It's just horrible.
Right, the patient's sitting here,
right,
the surgeons or physicians here at a computer just clicking away, back of the head towards the patient.
I saw a kind of a joke on that. I can't forget who the colleague was. He put a mask of his face on the back of his head for a video.
So, well, I guess Brave New World coming up. We'll have to see how this all pans out. But the good part is, we still got cataract surgery. I love cataract surgery. So, I mean, I hate to tell you, I'd probably do it for free, right? Go on these charity trips, we do it for free.
Listen, we have a foundation. I raise money so we can do free surgery.
Yeah.
I mean, just think about that. It comes down to this, and this is another thing for the young people. I was a fourth-year medical student. And it was early in the fourth year. I was going to be a chest surgeon. I was playing touch football in Central Park, across from Sinai. I got hit in the left eye with a football and got a hyphema. They put me in bed on the Zell wing, which is where we had the ophthalmology wing. In those days, bilateral patches. I was there for 10 days. And I was listening. I was in a room with two other beds. And I listened to the residents making rounds with the attendings. Fascinated by it because my exposure had been nil to that point in medical school. So I went to our chief and I said, you know, I have an elective coming up at the end of my year. I think I'd like to spend that time in ophthalmology and get more about it. I'd already signed my first year of a 7-year chest surgery training program. And after the two and a half, I just thought this is what sold me on ophthalmology, because we didn't have imaging. But we had the Goldman lens.
You could see everything.
You could see everything with that Goldman lens.
Yeah.
And I was agape. I was so fascinated that you could see the pathology. Because as I said, the cardiologist was king because...
Hearing these little minute clicks.
We had an EKG. I don't even think we had echoes then.
Yeah.
So we didn't have any of the imaging, but we had a Goldman lens. And you could see the retina. It was just fascinating. So I went back to my chief. And I said, you know, I think I really want to do ophthalmology instead of chest surgery. And he said, only do it if it challenges you intellectually and you want it to be your life. Otherwise, it's just going to become a job. And that stayed with me. And I don't know if the passion I have for it is because of his stimulation, but it challenged me intellectually. And that's why I've done so much research. That's why I've published so much, because I'm challenged by it. I want to know about the dead bag. All right? I want to know those things.
Such great advice.
Yeah.
Boy, great. Thank goodness you were hit in the eye by the football and got a high fever. Changed your life.
It's serendipity of life. It is the serendipity of life.
Like you said earlier, life is what happens to you when you're you're too busy trying to plan for it.
Exactly.
Wow, Sam, I had a fantastic interview with you. Thank you so much for doing this podcast.
This was a lot of fun.
Wasn't this great?
Much more fun than I thought it would be. This is great.
And thank you for being such an incredible mentor to me over the years. including now. And no, I do jokingly say that I am the resident who broke Sam Masket, only because after he attended me, he stopped attending resident. So I just felt guilty that maybe I said something, maybe I did something wrong.
Well, the truth is, I really appreciate what you are bringing to people. You've created a great teaching model, and I think mentoring is everything, which is why we have a fellowship. I'm involved in minority mentoring in the academy, and so I think mentoring is just everything. You must pass the baton. And for people who are getting on in years, don't forget that. Pass the baton.
At your peak.
Right.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks for enjoying that podcast with me. I trust that you learned a lot and it was well worth the small time investment. We're going to have more podcasts coming. We have next weekend, next Sunday, is one more, the very final one of our curriculum series, part 25. And now that we're done with the curriculum series, starting later this month, every Sunday, we're going to have a brand new podcast for you for the whole year. A lot of great material. Remember, you can also listen to these podcasts audio only while you're driving to work or exercising in the gym. They're available on Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google, anywhere you find your podcasts. Check it out and please subscribe.